Hello, and welcome to Making Creativity Pay, the podcast where we talk to people in creative industries about how they promote and market their work. I'm Dan Barnett, and on this episode I'll be speaking to comedy producer and director Dec Munro. Dec has directed loads of Edinburgh Fringe shows for performers such as Stuart Goldsmith, Marwan Rizwan, Angela Barnes, and many, many more. We talk about the role of a director in a show, about drawing out ideas and getting the best from an artist, whether taking a show to Edinburgh is right for everyone, as well as moving from the fringe to TV, and if the TV industry does enough to nurture scripted comedy. Dec is also co-founder of the Bill Murray Comedy Club in London. We talk about how that came about, the London comedy scene, the embarrassment of riches London comedy goers have, and how the "so what do you do for a living" clips on social media may impact what people expect from a comedy show. Dec also runs beginner stand-up comedy courses, both to individuals and in a corporate setting, and we discuss how this attracts both those who want to make a go of being a comedian and those that realise that the skills of a comedian are transferable to their day job. I started by asking Dec to give a quick introduction about himself and his work.
Dec Munro, I'm a comedy director, live comedy director, and comedy teacher and dramaturg, a co-founder, co-part owner of the Bill Murray Comedy Venue in Islington in London.
There's various strings to your bow. I think I first became aware of your stuff because a previous guest, Stuart Goldsmith, on the podcast, you became his director on his Edinburgh show this year. So just wondering kind of how you got involved, and, you know, I've always kind of found it a little bit strange about kind of getting involved in a solo show as a director.
So I got involved because Stu kindly emailed me. We've been in touch quite a lot in the past, and I know him reasonably well, and I really like him as a person. I think he's a funny, very funny comedian, and I admire his get up and go as well. So he messaged me, I think, in December and basically said, "Mate, I'm looking for a director. Would you be up for a chat?" And we'd had one previous chat in the past, and which was really, really nice. And I felt that it'd be really interesting to work with him. And also this year, he said he wanted to do something he hasn't done in the past, which is basically taken an issues-based show. And I've now been directing since 2015. And the issue he wanted to approach was climate change, and particularly from the perspective of his, I guess, overwhelming existential angst and fear around climate change, and then make it funny. And I also think it's an incredibly important area. And I directed a show in 2022, La Ricote Girl, Latin Deaf, which was, to a significant extent, about the same issue, but approached from it in a very different way. So I was on board, and then how does it work being a director of a solo show, or a sole person show? I'd say Adam Brace, rest in peace, who was a brilliant director who worked primarily at the Soho Theatre and was involved in a huge amount of incredible projects. He used to call directing comedy shows hardcore dramaturgy. And I think that probably is what it is, which is wrestling with the script and helping people to draw out elements that are interesting to them. So for me, when I sit down with somebody, I'll have a kind of introductory chat and just say, you know, what do you want from the show? What do you think you're maybe capable of achieving? What would feel like a win to you? Because often if you take a show to Edinburgh or build something for Edinburgh, there will be someone you know who will become massively successful, and it probably won't be you statistically. So sitting down and thinking, what is the win for you? And what kind of show do you want to build? And maybe that's a couple of positive reviews. Maybe that's some amazing pull quotes. Maybe that's a tour afterwards. Maybe that's bringing the show to London. Maybe that's, from a personal perspective, getting noticeably better as a comedian, or whatever it might be. And then agreeing that that's reasonable, and then starting to figure out how to help them create a show that's the best version of the ideal show they have in their own minds. So that doesn't necessarily mean it's objectively the best show, or even, I mean, that would be a strange thing to aim for, or what I think the best show might be. It's to help them figure out for themselves what they want the show to be in its best form and how to get to that.
And so with The Fringe now, is it the case that you have to go up there with a fully formed show? You can't just kind of go there, spend the month almost showcase and building a work in progress within the month? It has to be pretty polished before you go, just because of the whole financial constraints now.
Yeah, I think it depends on your situation. And also, I'm definitely not the oracle of comedy. I've got quite strong opinions, but, you know, other people have equally strong opinions that might differ from mine, and they have just as much right to them, obviously. I think going to Edinburgh, unless you happen to be a billionaire, and sort of creating work whilst you're there, although that's what Edinburgh should be about, it is now so expensive, even if it's just accommodation, that it feels like learning on the fly is much harder and developing. It is the case that there are some very big comedians who could go there, know that they've got a guaranteed audience, maybe do it in a slightly smaller room than they might do somewhere else, and use it as a chance to be in Edinburgh, see lots of shows, and be part of a community in a way they wouldn't be if they were out on tour all the time. And I feel like that's incredibly beneficial for them. But as a kind of general rule, if you're one, two or three shows in to Edinburgh, then taking something up that feels like it's not yet at its best point and that it needs a lot of work, in my experience, watching people over the years who've done that, can be very, very, very stressful for them. And there is a kind of wonderful artistic sensibility that says, go up, create something, make it beautiful while you're there, and have the best possible time at Edinburgh. I've seen a lot of people do that or try to do that, and I haven't seen many examples when it's really worked. And I'm thinking specifically of somebody who had an unbelievably brilliant, as successful as you can, Edinburgh in the early 2010s, and then took a show up where they were building that show every night. And I think if they had the chance to not do that again, I think they would not do that again.
Yes, I think that's what it's kind of gone from something a bit free-flowing to, I guess, unfortunately, a lot more commercial. And yes, you kind of need to be there. You need to be selling tickets. You can't just play to, you know, one man and his dog and build an audience over the month. You need to be 70, 80% capacity, if not selling out right from the get-go. Otherwise, you're looking at a big loss.
Yeah, I think there are other things you can do. Like you could take a show. I emceed a show at Edinburgh for a couple of years, and I called it Edinburgh Must Sees and put it on the Free Fringe. And that sold out every single day without any flyering at all, because it had a good title. And if I was also building a show, that probably would have paid for me to be at the Fringe. And so maybe there's a world where if you want to build work, you make it very, very clear that it's a work in progress and very clear that you're up there to either have fun or learn more about your practice or be better on stage or similar, but also have something that covers your cost. And I don't, you know, maybe it's possible to start thinking about it like that, because I would hate for the Fringe just to be full of in utterly polished, this is a trade show, shows where people are hoping to, in inverted commas, get something from it for their, in inverted commas, investment. Although equally, you don't want to see somebody spend an awful lot of money without really thinking about it, especially if they can't realistically expect to see that back, or worse, can't afford to lose that money.
And in terms of, you know, you're talking about people getting different things out of their show. So one of the previous shows you directed was Moan's show Juice, which has obviously now gone on to be a successful BBC Three show.
Yes.
How do you think, I know maybe difficult for you to speak for, on his behalf, but do you think in his head he had a TV show in his mind that's what it would be almost before he started?
Ooh, I don't think before he started, no. He's brilliant. And when we initially met, which is kind of January, February of 2018, it went up to Edinburgh in 2018. The show was more a kind of standard clown comedy show. And then over cups of tea, I sort of said to Moan, are there any other stories that you haven't told me outside of the show as it currently exists, or the show that currently exists? And he started telling me how he'd got famous on YouTube, and then he'd got his brother into the kind of YouTube shows that he was doing, and the YouTube episodes and the YouTube clips, and his mum. And then at, I think, a few years before we met, so maybe 2013, 2012, his mum had got a call. He'd got a call from Bollywood. His mum had been in kind of three or four episodes at that time, and effectively saying, would his mum, at that point an English teacher, 62-year-old English teacher in Essex, I think, would she like to star in the Bollywood equivalent of the TV show at that time, Neighbours, kind of daily soap, going out to multiple millions of people. And so we talked about that, and then he talked about the fact that his brother hadn't had acting training and was starring in Informer, which was that year's big BBC TV show opposite Paddy Considine, and was an incredible show. And Moan had training, and I think one of his first jobs was a fairly demeaning job, arguably. And so then you've got a kind of narrative of him making other people vastly more successful than he is, and being, in inverted commas, although he loves them, annoyed at them. So I think then that is that's a narrative that's very interesting, I guess, for TV. I mean, on day three or four, it was in the Pleasance in the Dome. There were seven people in the room, and Moan built extra things. I sort of suggested extra things, and he built them and then added to them, particularly a kind of exit role where it would look like a credit sort of rolling over the screen with different callbacks to various different things that happened in the show. And all that stuff was built in maybe the first week or so. And it started to feel like a really fun, good show at the end of the first week. but there was definitely a point where it really didn't feel like it was going to catch fire. And I think he's always been very, very ambitious, and he's very talented. He can definitely back it up. But there was no point at which we were saying, this is going to be a TV show one day. that wasn't a conversation that ever came up, maybe in the back of his mind, but not something that he ever expressed to me.
I was going to say, it's a shame with something like that. I think, you know, where there's going to be more of it, but it's difficult to know, I guess, when you're producing for TV, you know, how long something's got, where the whole arc of it could have done multiple series. You know, you could have built up with him being a bit of a loser for the first series, almost with a promise of redemption at the end of series one and so on. But, you know, you've got to kind of build the whole thing because, yes, there may only ever be one season. I guess it's a difficult balance.
Yes, I'm sure you're right. I wasn't privy to those discussions, to be honest. But I imagine that you probably want to take the absolute best bits of the show itself and then build in everything to give it the possibility of a second series. And then you figure out the problem of having a second series once you've got to that point.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen a lot of talk recently about kind of a lack of scripted comedy within TV. I don't know how much you've kind of worked with people in that area or mm-hmm. things that have gone on to become TV. I mean, do you think that TV in general is playing safe and doesn't take risks on things like that?
With a little bit of knowledge of Mwan's show and a few other shows that I've been maybe even more intimately involved in, I'm aware of the investment that goes into it, the sort of huge financial and the length of time it can take. In an ideal world, I would absolutely love for, you know, commissioners to go out to a live comedy, see a particular act, develop them over time, or have people help them develop their work over time, and then introduce them to everybody and use their platforms in that way. But I'm also aware of the reality that that's incredibly hard, and that I'm a dramaturg for I'm the creative lead, it's called, for the Victoria Wood Prize, which is a big comedy playwriting prize. And having just done unconscious bias training, I'm also aware of, for anybody, there are gatekeepers, positive and negative, in every area of the arts. And if you were to adopt a model where one person were to kind of go out and pick people, where would they come from and how would that work? I think there are flaws in every single kind of model. And I think we're better at diversity now. I think it is deeply sad that there are seemingly very significantly fewer opportunities for people to break in as writers or as performers, and there's less money in almost every area. But I guess that's also, we're speaking now in December 2023 and post-pandemic, particularly the streamers, but I think everybody spent a lot of money very, very quickly on filming and building up a backlog of stuff that needs to be put out. And so there's maybe 6 to 12 to 18 months, as I understand, that's still sort of in that backlog. And so therefore the budgets are significantly lower right now, but that will come back at some point, hopefully. Yeah, I feel vastly underqualified to give an opinion on the state of kind of global TV comedy or UK TV comedy, but I do hope that good voices get a fair chance and that the system is set up in some ways to give them that opportunity. And I definitely think that there are, you see shows that clearly come from a very definite live concept and that are good or bad, and you see them occasionally being given backing. And if that were to completely stop, that would be disastrous.
Well, it's a podcast. You don't need to be qualified to have an opinion on one of these. One of the other things you mentioned is your co-founder of the Bill Murray Comedy Club.
Yes.
Did you feel that there was something missing and you wanted to set something up, or how did it kind of come about?
So Barry Ferns and Sarah Pierce, who are two of the other co-owners and co-founders, had founded Angel Comedy at the Camden Head in Islington, which is a room above a pub. They founded it in 2011. Barry and then Sarah joined within about a month. And that went from one night a week to effectively 7 nights a week within about 4 or 5 years. And I went a couple of times and it was brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And Simon Pierce was someone who owned the Invisible Dot, which was the club which now sits where Two North Down is in King's Cross. And he put on a whole bunch of really great experimental nights, and a lot of great comedy came through there. But I spoke with him about a bunch of different things, but he basically asked my advice on some small things. He took some of my advice, didn't take a lot of it. And I know he was taking advice from lots of different people. Barry came to me when they were thinking about getting a premises and said, "Deck, would you be interested? We think we found somewhere and we need a couple more people." And it was the year after I directed my first show, and that was Sophie Hagen's show, Bubble Wrap, which had thankfully won the Newcomer Prize. So I probably had more knowledge and awareness of comedy, but also maybe had started to develop a very small, not that my name has grown much bigger, but a very small name of myself for myself. So they came to me, and then I have a background where I sort of understand a bit about financially type stuff. And I also feel I've got quite strong views on particular types of comedy. And I don't know that there was necessarily a gap. I think there was the opportunity for Angel Comedy to take this particular place. And for me, what really mattered was that it felt welcoming to anybody, irrespective of what kind of comedy you like. Hopefully, if you come to the Bill Murray, you'll feel valued and welcomed. And that it shouldn't just be about selling tickets. So we put on shows where we don't think it's, you know, the venue could hold about 95-ish people. We know that those shows aren't going to sell out, but we think they have merit in lots of different ways, or we want to encourage artists. And so I think it's a kind of karma-led model where you put good stuff out there, whether that be, you know, we feel that we give a very, well, we do give a very significant income, amount of income from the ticket sales if you're doing an hour-long show, which makes it financially viable or helps make it financially viable to be a comedian working in London. So we do that, but we also do weekly writing gyms for aspiring comedians, and we have bursary schemes to come on courses, and we have lots of different things that we think make it more accessible to be involved in comedy. And we also have free shows where there's a bucket collection afterwards as well, quite regularly. So you could be a student in London and come and see comedy at the Bill Murray 3 or 4 nights a week and almost never pay for a ticket. So yeah, we think all those things are important. I should stress that although I am a part owner and I am a co-founder, we've got an amazing staff and they do almost all the important things. And there are 3 co-owners who do lots and lots of things. So I don't want to be the person who's sitting on a podcast saying it's me, because that's the absolute opposite. There are loads of really, really good people who manage on a day-to-day basis, who book acts on a day-to-day basis, who do the back-end tech ticket stuff on a day-to-day basis. And all of those people are very, very good at their job. And that's the reason the Bill Murray is a good place.
If somebody came to you, said they want to be a comedian, they've got that interest, I mean, would you try and stop them in the first place? I mean, it's probably a difficult job. It's probably always been a difficult thing to become as your career, and probably even harder now. Yes. I mean, I'm kind of amazed, you know, within London that, you know, you can see top quality acts for like 8-10 quid somewhere.
Yeah.
The range, the number of people, the price is great for a consumer, but it must be so hard to kind of make a living from that, especially, you know, London prices, you know, of prices of living.
Yes, I think so. If someone came to me, and people have occasionally come to me and said that, I'm biased. I teach courses. I teach a beginner's comedy course, which is a kind of week-long introductory course. And I think, what would I say to them? I think I'd say that, and this is true of any kind of area of the arts, I think, if you're really into making it, into doing it, the worst thing in life is getting to 85 and not having tried to do the things that you want to do, or not having been your best self. But it is sensible maybe to think about a career in comedy as a sort of, I think Ben Tarjay said this to me, a university, maybe your first 3 years of university. So you're learning and you're not expecting to be getting paid. And then maybe by year 4, you might be expecting to get paid. That's not to say it will cover your bills, and it's not to say it will be a full living or a professional career, but you will spend a minimum of 3 years basically not being paid for the work that you do. And if you're going to get good, you're probably going to have to do that work most nights of the week, realistically. So that obviously advantages people who are in a positive, in a good financial situation to start off with, very sadly. Yeah. But if someone wants to do it, then I would very strongly encourage them to try. And if we look at the people who are now very successful TV comedians, I don't know that many of them would have been the person on their first or second or third gig that anyone would have said that person's going to be super famous. And there are a whole multitude of them who worked really hard and were out there gigging every single night of the week and got good because they decided this is the thing they wanted to do. So I don't think it's disingenuous to say that almost anyone could do it, but you'd have to decide that this was the only thing you were going to do, and you'd have to commit to kind of 8 to 10 years of doing it. And that's a lot, and it's not guaranteed. And you'd also be around people who sometimes can be sad if they're not making it or if they're finding it hard. So yeah, would I encourage people to follow the thing that they want to do? Absolutely, categorically, yes.
So you're talking about, you have beginner's comedy course, you have a corporate equivalent as well. How often on the beginner's comedy, is it someone who just wants to scratch the itch a little bit and kind of perform once, or someone who thinks, I'd like to do this, but I want to kind of get a proper feel for it?
So I've now been doing this for about 3 years. So I feel like I can speak with real confidence on it. And there are probably about 6 intensive courses every year. And I think it's split into thirds. So we'll have roughly 15, 16 people on each course. And maybe a third of them will be people who will be interested in comedy and know a lot about it and maybe would listen to this kind of podcast and want, you know, have thought about it for a long time and maybe want to go off and do loads of stand-up afterwards. And then maybe a third of people from a professional career, like off in the law, who are in some way dissatisfied and feel like they're smart, interesting people, but might use it primarily in their day-to-day jobs and are realistically not going to give up a very successful career in something else to go and spontaneously decide to be a stand-up. And then a third are people who are doing it alongside a course in sushi and just like doing courses. Mm. So it's a third want to carry on often, a third who will use it for their professional career, and a third who are just like, ah, yeah, sure. But I kind of encourage everyone on the course to, well, they all join a WhatsApp group at the start of the course. And normally I set them a task after the course, which is to do their, you know, maybe 2 or 3 gigs in the first month if they want to. Not everyone carries on, obviously. And normally by about 6 months out, about probably 35% of them are still gigging. And then the rest are incorporating them into their daily life. They're still in touch with each other and they meet up every so often, I think. That's a sort of rough breakdown of people looking to continue and people who just kind of take it because it's interesting and people who take it because it's part of their professional development.
When people come in, how many almost have a short 5-10 minute thing in their head that they want to expand on, and how many just want to say, I'd like to try and be funny?
So I try and encourage them to build it over the period of a week. So to maybe disregard their own set. Maybe 2 or 3 people have done some gigs beforehand. I have taught people who've had huge amounts of experience, like Big O Venn, who won Britain's Got Talent, came and did a course. It was pretty noticeable. He was very good. Just to be clear, I'm in no way taking any credit for his success. He's amazing. Very much not that. He's amazing. But it was very apparent that he was very good. He was on the same course as someone who writes for a very famous UK comedian and does a lot of their writing. And both of them knew a lot of comedic concepts sort of somewhat quicker than other people. So you do get interesting people on the courses. I've had Luciana Berger, the ex-MP, and the most recent one, someone who's about to be a Radio 1 DJ, and a couple of people who, strangely enough, have been actual Hollywood stars have done the course. So it's quite interesting when those people come in because often they have real presenting skills or they've got real charisma on stage, and then when you give them the tools of kind of joking, joke structures and persona, they can use them brilliantly very, very quickly. But it's also people who come in who've got absolutely nothing. And on the most recent course, there's a guy called Ronan who was Irish, who won the course, who won his place on the course in a lottery organised by Angel Comedy. We do Aisling B organises a food bank benefit, which is actually happening on the next Wednesday. I think that's the 20th of December, and it's raised a lot of money for food banks. And then she does a gig every year at the Bill Murray, and he won it in that and came along. And I don't think he had much interest really in comedy, but he was brilliant and really lovely and just really nice. And within a week, I think he probably will carry on because he got swept up in it. So yeah, so most people come with a little bit of knowledge about comedy or some interest, and some people, there are outliers who've just got this huge bank of knowledge who probably know more and have seen more live comedy than me.
So you're saying about some of the corporate stuff, and I know Stuart does something similar as well, where he talks about resilience and what comedy can teach you about resilience. I mean, do you find a similar kind of thing, that, you know, being able to stand up in front of people, tell a joke, you know, there's all sorts of skills that you can use in other walks of life?
Oh yes, absolutely. I think it's incredible for team building, for example. Like I do a redux version, a small version of the week-long intensive course to corporates and give them all the tools that you would get in that week-long course, but very quickly. And then they all do kind of a minute at the end, and you give them a little trophy, which is a really lovely team building exercise and team bonding exercise. But it's useful in relationship building. It's useful in Stu's area, not mine so much, but in resilience. I think it's really useful in facilitating a kind of common ground with anybody in that kind of relationship building style as well. And then just as a kind of fun variant on the, lots of big corporates have kind of 1 or 2 days where they go away and they get given their results or whatever, and they want, you know, two or three different things to do during that day that kind of break it up, and to maybe go away with, here's how to use a microphone properly, here's how to deliver and tell a joke, and here's maybe how to think about your comic persona, and to do that very quickly in a way that's quite fun. And then also maybe be able to sort of tease your colleagues about it a little bit, or get teased in a nice way, is really lovely. And I didn't expect to like that kind of work, but I actually have seen the impact it has, and I really, really enjoy it.
Going back to stand-up in general, I mean, how much do you think it's changed in the last few years, where there's a lot more online kind of character sketch-based comedy? There's a lot of what's your job? You know, what do you do for a living kind of stuff? How much do you think things have changed in the last few years with a much more of an online presence for comedians?
Well, I notice it as a director in that now people who've primarily built their followings online or have entirely done that are getting the opportunity to tour or to perform at quite big venues and need someone to come in and be the live director on their shows to basically help structure it and maybe even help them map out a sort of real journey for their online character so that it's an engaging show. So that's obviously a massive, massive change. And TikTok and Instagram, it's incredible to see people that you wouldn't know are from the live circuit who can go and sell certainly 200, possibly even 500 tickets at all kinds of relatively esoteric UK towns that wouldn't always be on anybody else's tour map. So that's incredible. And it's really interesting working with them because they've obviously got an incredible skill set, often for maybe having one or two characters that they do a sort of specific type of joke with, and then thinking, okay, how can you build a world for this? And how can you make that person feel comfortable? Because often the audience are really coming to see the person do the thing they're famous for, and they're happy to be in the same room as the person. But the person, for their own sake and to extend their career and to build on it, will often use it as an opportunity to get really good in a live context. And so they want to be doing things that aren't giving the audience exactly what they want. They're doing that, but they're also doing stuff that's going to allow them to get better. And so finding ways to do that effectively is really helpful.
Exactly. Yeah. You don't want to be doing the catchphrase for an hour. You want to kind of be expanding on it. And yes, like you said, building the character or fleshing it out. And I mean, in terms of, you know, the kind of clips of, you know, what do you do for a living? You know, it's because obviously you might have a structured set with maybe a couple of 5-minute bits that are a lot more freeform. And those are the bits that go online because you don't want to give your set away. But have you found that then when people come to a show, they almost expect it to be a lot more freeform? And, you know, there's always question, you know, whether it's just a case of, you know, people always think, oh, it was better in my day, but whether crowds are not as well behaved as they used to be because they're more used to that kind of interaction because they see it online?
That's a great question. The Bill Murray, we curate our audiences, so we don't let groups more than about 6 or 8 in. We don't really let hen or stag do's in. And I can only think of like 1 or 2 nights where they do a lot of crowd work. And that's Vittorio Angeloni, who's a great comedian, runs one. And I know that he clips up a lot of the stuff that he does there. Are audiences worse behaved? No, not the audiences that I have experience or exposure to. That's not to say they're not. And I know that it was a big thing after the pandemic. Is it changing audiences' relationships with performers, i.e. they expect much more in terms of crowd work? I think probably longer term, yes. I haven't really seen that yet, but I'm sure if your only experience of comedy from the age of 14 onwards is crowd work stuff and you go to a comedy venue at the age of 50 or at the age of 19, you're definitely going to expect that to be a big part of the show that you see. And there's the benefit not just of that going online, but also that feels immediate, it feels unique, even if we know that it isn't always unique and it has been prepared and it's been done elsewhere, and the kind of the skill of the comedian is to make something feel unique, even if it's been it's a repurposed version of a joke they might have already told. That's a really great question. What would be your view on it, Dan?
I think generally you'll find some people, you know, you'll always get the odd arsehole, obviously, you know, especially in a club where, because it's part of Steve's act, actually, you know, I'm sure you've heard many times that he talks about he's effectively, you know, being a comedian, he's there to facilitate the sale of alcohol in a club. And, you know, if the alcohol doesn't get sold, he doesn't get booked, you know, blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, he's almost there to kind of help people be functioning alcoholics. Yeah, well, exaggeration. But it's interesting that, yes, there's probably a lot of clubs like that where it's a bit more of a bear pit. But generally speaking, I think more the problem is, from what I've seen, the problem is where someone is involved in the crowd work, but then wants to make it too much about themselves. They won't let it go. Once they've been given a bit of the spotlight,
yes,
they're kind of like, thanks, that's great, I'm moving on now. But, you know, they kind of want to still be part of the act.
Yes, I think that's a really good point. And that makes complete sense to me. I think you've probably got at least as much knowledge as I have on that. I did see John Robbins' tour show recently, which I have no involvement in, and I really enjoyed Howl. And to a very significant extent, his show is about his problems with alcohol, essentially. And it's very, 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 very funny. But at the break, this was at the Apollo, he said, okay, guys, well, thanks. Now, please go and get some beers. Because otherwise these kind of shows can't really happen in a venue like this. Although obviously, you know, I won't be joining you. And he did it in a much funnier way, but acknowledging the awkwardness of that was really interesting. And yes, I was there when Stu came up with his line about capering for the enjoyment of blah. And I really like that he recognises it in the show. I think it's really, really funny.
Do people who are looking to do Edinburgh shows, are they contacting you already, or is there like a kind of mass panic around February, March? Is there like a kind of peak time where all of a sudden you get lots of people knocking on your door?
There are sort of three waves. And just to be clear, I'm always glad to hear from comedians. If anyone's out there, then please do get in touch. But normally you get people getting in touch now. And so that started to happen. And that's often through managers or agents, because managers or agents maybe make comedians be a bit more organized. And then you get another wave in February, March, often coinciding with somebody being two or three days away from their Leicester show and thinking, hang on, I really need to make sure that this show is a show. Or having had a couple of work in progress shows and feeling like they now need some help on working it up. And then you get people from May to maybe the start of July in different levels of, oh, hang on, I really need some help now, who get in touch. And that tends to be the kind of waves. And then occasionally you get someone contacted me this Edinburgh to direct them, not this Edinburgh coming, but the Edinburgh after. So 2 years in advance, wow, which was amazing. And they actually, I think, do have a really good show. But if I were a comedian, I would not be that good at advance planning.
Previous episode, which I've recorded, is coming out soon with Liam Withnail. Cool. He kind of says he kind of starts in January in his mind, you know, so it kind of runs, his year runs August to August, but he has a kind of, you know, post fringe couple of months, kind of a bit more downtime, still gigging comedian, but not thinking about a show. And then January kind of ramp back up. Does comedy still run on that August to August timeline? Or do you think it's becoming, the fringe is becoming less of a focus? Like you said, there's Leicester, there's Glasgow, there's McCunclith, there's lots of other, Buxton. There's lots of places now where can you almost kind of save the whole kind of investment, time, money of doing Edinburgh and just kind of pick and choose and kind of develop? Or do you think actually, if you're serious, you need to be in Edinburgh?
I think there are people who view Edinburgh as being the be all and end all. I can think of one particular agency where they say, you know, act at least in the early stage of their career need to go up every year to get better. I do think if you're performing every day for a month, you're going to get a lot better. But I don't think it's the be all and end all. So the positives and negative positives of Edinburgh, I guess, are you're there performing every day for a month. That's amazing. In the final week, there's a lot of TV people, a lot of people who could possibly get you big work and big bookers and whatever for various different things. And that doesn't really exist in any other festival. And that, you know, the fact that the TV festival's there from the Tuesday or Wednesday of the final week of Edinburgh means there's a lot of people looking for interesting stuff to see. So those two things are a benefit. I think also you get a creative community outside of comedy, people in theatre, people in dance, people in all kinds of different disciplines. And it's fascinating and interesting to see all their work because you can go and be inspired by different things and have really interesting conversations. And I think Edinburgh in and of itself, the festival is incredible. And for me, it's my favourite place in the world to be there in August. It's genuinely, utterly, mind-bendingly, brilliantly wonderful. But you can build a career online. You can be picky and choosy about the festivals you go to. You could start doing, you know, if we figured out two Google search words between ourselves and called it, I don't know, cheap flights AI and set up a comedy night called that, you know, then we could probably get some level of attention, or we could finesse that and get a better title, but we could start getting attention for ourselves in London, not pay as much, or wherever we were based. And I wonder if people, Liam Withnail's obviously just had an amazing Edinburgh. I wonder if you were to say, right, I'm going to spend January to August thinking about how to make myself the best comedian possible, and then get attention for whatever I'm doing. If the best thing for everybody is to go to the Fringe, I probably don't think it is. And people feel that because everyone else is doing it, that's what they should do. And I wonder if it's worth just sitting down and thinking, okay, I'm a comedian and I happen to be interested in stamp collecting. And there are 3.1 million people in the country who are interested in stamp collecting. I'm going to set up a comedy night called Stamp Collectors. And I'm going to get in touch with the Stanley Gibbons shop on the Strand in London. And I'm going to ask to be in their magazine as their resident comedy correspondent. That magazine has, I think, 80,000 people who read it every month and is still like a really well-read magazine. That number might be wrong now, but it was right at one point. And I'm going to be the person who does, you know, jokes about stamp collecting, if that's something that people are particularly into. And then you've got a niche that no one else is going for, of a lot of people who would love you to tell jokes about the difference between, I don't know, a penny black and a some other stamp. And great. So I think there are lots of different ways of thinking about it, and putting yourself up into what is effectively a trade marketplace with loads of other people competing on a sometimes unfair playing field without thought. I'm not sure if that is something that everybody needs to do necessarily. So it shouldn't be the be-all and end-all. It can feel like the be-all and end-all. I don't think it is the be-all and end-all.
No, fantastic. Thank you so much for your time. I'll put links to everything in the show notes, like the courses, the Bill Murray, your website and everything. But is there anything kind of coming up soon that you want to kind of mention?
I've got a website, dakmonroe.com, I think. And I teach regularly. Teach courses at the Bill Murray. And if you're a comedian, you're interested in having a chat about a show, I'd love to do that. I also do Outside Eyes regularly, helping people build up work. And if you're thinking about doing comedy and you're listening to this, then please go and watch loads and please go and do it, whether or not you do a course. I think it is an amazing thing to do and an amazing thing to be involved in, irrespective of some of the things that I've said to Dan during this. What about you, Dan? What are you up to for Christmas and New Year? What would you like to promote?
I mean, the podcast, because it's interesting, you know, I kind of started this talking about, you know, wanting to do the podcast about talking about promotion and marketing and, you know, kind of talking to people about it, but also, you know, learning myself about how to promote and market something. And it's that kind of thing that it's a hard slog. And I imagine it's the same for anyone kind of starting out in any kind of creative industry about kind of, there's such competition for eyeballs and attention now that, yes, you almost have to do something out there. Or, you know, it's easy to get attention if you're happy to be hated, but to get attention for something that people like is obviously a lot harder, and it's difficult to kind of break through. But I found that, you know, frustrating, but an interesting and a learning process.
I that is interesting. I talk to people when I direct shows about the narrative in the show and the narrative outside of the show. So the narrative in the show is whatever the show's about. The narrative outside of it. When I helped Sophie with her first show, Bubble Wrap, we basically faked a bunch of things for press attention. She said that there was a misprint in one of the programs saying that the show was going to start on a Friday. It was actually going to start on a Saturday. And so she came on the Friday and she discovered it on the Friday in inverted commas. And then we asked 10 people to stand outside and she did a show to 10 people. And that got a bit of press attention. And then there were a bunch of other sort of silly tricks that we did. And so I do think kind of figuring out if you can get into that kind of thing and gamify it, and if you feel like it would be interesting to you, there are lots of opportunities. I did something with Angela Barnes where we hired a minivan. She likes nuclear bunkers, and her show that year was about waking up in a nuclear bunker on her 40th birthday and it being the same day that Donald Trump was elected, and saying, I'm going to stay in a nuclear bunker forever now, for understandable reasons. So we hired because we had a couple of drinks together, and I said, wouldn't it be fun to hire a minivan and go to a nuclear bunker and maybe do a show there, not expecting her to say yes. And she was like, yeah, that'd be amazing. So I sorted out and we drove 70 miles to go with 15 people to a show at a nuclear bunker, and she emceed it, and then four of her friends performed to an audience of 10 people. And it feels like in comedy there's a world where you can kind of decide this would be fun, and then some people, and find people who'll be up for it, and so whatever. Yeah. And then maybe you find, after you found what you want to do, you kind of find out and you think, what's the marketing angle for it? Possibly I'm not great at that, but it's interesting to try and find ways of gamifying it and just thinking, okay, what I want to do is pretend to be a frog. Who's going to be interested in me pretending to be a frog? Great, I'll go out to the Frog Collector Society and organize a comedy night for the Frog Collector Society. And suddenly you're doing the thing that you want to a bunch of people who are engaged and interested in the thing that you want to do.
Thanks for listening. There's more details in the show notes about Deck, his work, comedy courses, and the Bill Murray. If you enjoyed this, check out our other episodes where we speak to a number of performers about their experiences at the Edinburgh Fringe, as well as creatives in a variety of other industries about making creativity pay.